I'll try and make it as colourful as possible. And so the paper I'm going to give today is based on a new chapter in my PhD thesis, so any feedback and comments at the end will be greatly appreciated. And also, as a quick disclaimer before we get going, this talk is going to contain some unpleasant descriptions of parasitic skin infections, so consider yourselves broadly warned. In the summer of 1940, under the arches of Hungerford Bridge, Bernard Nichols stumbled upon a prize-winning specimen. Nichols, a conscientious objector who had spent the first year of the Second World War as a social worker on the streets of London, had recently been tasked with establishing an air raid shelter beneath the bridge by Westminster Council and the Anglican Pacifist Fellowship. The shelter, christened the Hungerford Club, was designed to cater to a diverse group of misfits who were considered unfit to mix with the general population in conventional sites of refuge. These people included rough sleepers, alcoholics, and the mentally ill. However, within a few weeks of the shelter's opening, it became clear to Nichols and his fellow volunteers that the club's patrons required more than just hot meals, clean beds, and a place to shelter from German bombs. Many required urgent medical and hygienic attention. Perhaps most pressingly of all, volunteers discovered that patrons' bodies and clothing were riddled with lice, mites, and other parasitic invaders after months spent sleeping on street corners and in overcrowded relief centres. It was this particular aspect of their labour that first brought the Hungerford Club to the attention of researchers here at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, who reached out to Nichols in the hope of brokering a very unusual kind of deal. In the Department of Entomology, scientists engage in the study of insect-borne diseases such as typhus, scabies, and trench fever, had been searching for large supplies of parasites to sustain their lab investigations. As such, staff at the school contacted a number of charitable organisations who were considered to be in contact with potentially infectious communities to ask that they supply them with any infested clothing removed from their impoverished charges. This request led to something of a bizarre competition between different charitable groups, as volunteers desperately searched for the most extreme kinds of infestation to present to these new scientific partners. It was this very competition that Nichols claimed to have won that night underneath the arches of Hungerford Bridge, after encountering what he described as, and here I quote, the most lousy person who had ever been known to exist. As Nichols recalled some 40 years later, and here I quote from an interview with Nichols at length, he came in very ill, so we took him to St. Stephen's Hospital and carried him to the casualty department. The orderly there just deposited the poor man on the floor and with his can of disinfectant ran a ring around him. I said, look, if we undertake to undress him and if you'll give us a bag, we'll stand within the circle of disinfectant and take off all of his clothing. Will you take him on from there? So we carefully put all of his clothing in this bag and closed it up. However, when we got down to the skin, I was absolutely horrified. All the outside skin, on this man's back particularly, had gone. On the whole of his back, from his neck down to his buttocks, was just a wet mass of pus. The researchers were terribly pleased. They meticulously went over every inch of the man's clothing and picked off all of the dead lice. My recollection is their count was around 15,000. Nichols' testimony provides us with a number of starting points for today's paper. Firstly, it introduces us to the paper's three main protagonists, the entomologist, the pacifist, and the homeless person. Secondly, it sheds light on the relationships and power dynamics between these three individuals, the entomologist as an authoritative director of research, the pacifist as his eager, deputised assistant, and the homeless person as at once an invaluable source of clinical material, but someone kept both literally and figuratively at arm's length. Finally, it introduces us to some of the tensions and contradictions that defined this infected body of wartime research, a body that was simultaneously viewed with visceral disgust, but also scientific desire. In this paper, I will examine the shifting perceptions of this infected body across three episodes of entomological research conducted by scientists at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine in the opening years of the Second World War. By investigating how the differing political, social, and economic statuses of these individuals, whose bodies served as both breeding grounds for parasitic populations and as clinical material for the testing of chemical insecticides, I hope to uncover some of the ways in which the labour of scientific research could shape discussions around community, identity, and belonging in wartime Britain. To do so, this paper utilises two interrelated concepts. Firstly, by examining the divergent experiences of these research populations, I will attempt to draw trace the shifting dimensions of what I call experimental citizenship. Here in I conceptualise citizenship not as a fixed legal status, but following the works of historians such as Sonia Rose, Nicoletta Gullis and Matthew Grant, as a dynamic relationship between an individual and a political community. Through this lens, citizenship functions as a system of transactions through which particular rights and privileges can be demanded or particular obligations asked for. These can range from abstract things such as identity, belonging and acceptance, or the more practical and material such as employment opportunities, welfare provision and legal protection. Experimental citizenship therefore refers to the ways in which the offering of one's body for scientific research can provide political, social and moral capital for these claims of inclusion. Relocating political concepts of identity and belonging to the level of the physical body also leads us to this paper's second key concept, the idea of different communities of pain. As Nicol's recollections so viscerally attest, participation in entomological research was frequently a painful process, one that involved experiencing the body as itchy, sore, and teeming with parasitic life. As such, I intend to explore how perceptions of this pain, both in one's own body and in the bodies of others, altered understandings of citizenship in the wartime context. In doing so, this paper looks towards a recent wave of scholarship on the social, communal, and emotional aspects of painful experiences, the general premise of this work being that pain is not an involuntary mechanical response, but rather an experience so profoundly filtered through political ideologies, social understandings, and moral and cultural values as to be inseparable from them. This much is evident in the recent work of the Birkbeck Pain Project, in which historians such as Joanna Burke, Carmen Mangian, Louise Hyde and Rob Bodis have explored the emergence of distinctive communities of pain across different cultures and time periods, groups who express or more often repress their pain according to particular scripts and expectations. This necessarily requires an awareness of the unequal and undemocratic nature of pain within any given society, with the suffering of some groups elevated while the suffering of others is minimised. Building on the insights of that existing work, this paper looks at how the construction of these communities of pain plays out on the ground level of scientific research. And for this, finally, it turns to the work of Sara Ahmed. For Ahmed, the everyday construction of boundaries between different social groups occurs in what she calls the contact zone of impressions. That is to say, sites in which different bodies congregate, interact, and leave lasting marks on each other, both physical and otherwise. In these moments of intimate contact, intense feelings such as pain allow certain bodies to be aligned with or positioned against others. positioned against others, leading to a transformation of both the physical space, as individuals seek proximity to or distance from one another, as well as the emotional space through the generation of feelings such as solidarity, hatred, or disgust. However, these are never pristine encounters, Ahmed argues. Rather, they are shaped under the weight of past histories of contact. Therefore, when scientists, pacifists, and the homeless meet, culturally embedded notions of dirt, disease, and disorder are brought to the surface and revived on the skin of the entomological subject. With this in mind, this paper takes seriously, and perhaps more literally than intended, Ahmed's assertion that it is here, on the skin's surface, that histories are made. So anxieties about infection were prevalent throughout government departments and public health authorities during the Second World War. The Medical Research Council, for example, listed the prevention of infectious diseases as its top wartime priority, citing the critical importance of typhus and malaria during the Great War, as well as the global devastation of the Spanish flu pandemic in the years afterwards. Such concerns informed many of the prominent public health tropes of the period, most famously in the Coughs and Sneezes Spread Diseases campaign, which we can see here, which explicitly tied notions of good citizenship to the prevention of infection and contamination. Putting aside its self-evident importance for a moment, it might be worth considering why infection mattered so much within a wartime society. There were, of course, numerous practical reasons to be concerned about the spread of infectious diseases, which posed a significant threat to military and industrial productivity through things like mortality, absenteeism, and fatigue. Furthermore, there was an awareness in government circles that outbreaks of illness negatively impacted public morale and national self-image and provided the opportunity for German propaganda to present the British as a weak and ailing people. We might also consider the symbiotic relationship between the languages of infection and the languages of war. As numerous scholars have observed, most prominently Susan Sontag in her classic book Illness as Metaphor, depictions of disease as an invading force which overwhelms the body's defences became increasingly common with the rise of germ theory in the second half of the 19th century. This is particularly applicable in the case of entomological infections, in which the insect vector provides a perhaps a more easily visualised enemy that requires destruction. With this in mind, it's perhaps unsurprising that at a time of great peril for geopolitical borders and boundaries, we see an attendant rise in anxiety about the security of the body's boundaries too. However, I argue we might find deeper roots still for these fears in the radically altered relationship between citizens and the British state under the conditions of total war. For a state to operate in such a conflict necessarily requires the dissolution of traditional structures of social organisation in a manner similar to what the sociologist Sigmund Bauman has identified as the transition towards a liquid modernity. While Bauman was here concerned with the growing plasticity and flexibility of social ties under conditions of late 20th century globalisation, we can see similar developments in the actions of the British war machine during this period, with its attempts to divide, rationalise and redistribute populations in line with particular wartime objectives. These various wartime programmes, which range from the conscription of workers, the evacuation of children and the detention and deportation of foreigners, required an unprecedented fluidity, flexibility and openness on the part of the bodies of British citizens. Yet this flexibility came at a price, giving birth to new anxieties about the instability of the body and its relation to broader society. As Bauman contends, this kind of worry often takes the form of what he calls a rabid, obsessive, feverish and overwrought concern with the body's defences and a vigilant policing of its surfaces, boundaries and orifices. In wartime Britain, this paranoia clearly could not be contained within the purely medical realm, influencing a much broader range of social behaviours concerned with the control, regulation and expulsion of potentially dangerous, polluting elements. We see this manifest in a number of wartime discourses, from the increasing hostility shown towards foreign aliens, 30,000 of whom were interned in camps or deported over the summer of 1940, to heightened fears about sexual and racial indiscretions between young women and African-American servicemen stationed in the country's towns and villages. Entomological research then provides something of a unique entry point into this feverish paranoia about wartime infection, both its social version and its organic version. In the contact zone of the laboratory, an anxious policing of bodily surfaces encounters experimental protocols in which bodies are necessarily made vulnerable and compromised for the purposes of advancing scientific knowledge. Therefore, by examining the ways in which different bodies interact with and negotiate around these conflicting demands, we may gain a greater insight into the way in which different groups were absorbed within or excluded from the wartime community. So, beginning with our first episode of research, during the First World War, the louse became the primary nemesis of medical entomologists, responsible for repeated outbreaks of typhus along the Western Front and perhaps as many as 450,000 cases of trench fever in the British Army alone. Despite intense research efforts, scientists failed to produce a treatment that could offer more than just a few days of protection in the unsanitary conditions of the trenches, and interest in the subject stalled with the end of hostilities in 1918. However, with the looming prospect of a new war in the late 1930s, research into the control of lice populations enjoyed something of a renaissance, particularly at the London School of Hygiene. In December 1939, the school's director of entomology, Patrick Alfred Buxton, applied for a grant from the Medical Research Council to fund lab studies on new chemical insecticides for both military and civilian uses. Conjuring a combined threat of epidemic disease on one hand and collapsing productivity on the other, Buxton secured the MRC's backing and experiments began in early 1940. This reorientation of the department towards wartime objectives mirrored a broader transformation in the school's academic environment in those early months of the Second World War. In September 1939, all regular teaching at the school was suspended, with staff instead providing intensive courses on tropical medicine for some 2,000 medics and military personnel. Furthermore, the school became a central node in the Emergency Public Health Laboratory Service, a national network of labs tasked with investigating threats to public health, which ranged from food poisoning to bacteriological warfare. As such, Buxton's team were not alone in having their scientific workload newly imbued with notions of wartime survival. The first task of Buxton's experiment was to procure significant numbers of lice to study their movements, behaviours and responses to different chemicals. However, since the lice refused to feed on animals and required a steady supply of human blood, the team decided that the only solution was to rear them on their own bodies. To do so, lice were placed inside a small pillbox with a gauze base and fitted to volunteers' legs, allowing the lice inside to feed and multiply. After a week, scientists went round and collected all the boxes and took them back to the lab for analysis and observation. Unable to produce enough lice just by themselves, for some reason, the team circulated a call for volunteers among school and MRC staff in January 1940, producing 25 volunteers in total. So here it's worth taking a moment to just have a look at this circular in some detail, because as you imagine, it would be quite a hard task to get people to rear lice on their bodies. This helps provide a number of insights into the way that scientists framed the experimental labours of rearing lice. So firstly, the rearing of lice is explicitly framed as an act of vital wartime labour, and therefore it's allied with their more conventional duties, such as their education of military personnel or their undertaking of public health investigations, with this far more unusual act, the kind of lumped together. Secondly, the labour is clearly gendered with a required suspension of bodily hygiene and comfort that's coded as a purely masculine endeavour. Although, interestingly, a year later, when they're more desperate, they decide to drop that. However, perhaps most interestingly, despite the construction of the act as something that's valuable, heroic, and masculine, the circular simultaneously goes to great lengths to emphasise the fact that it's an unobtrusive act, an act which is constrained, obscured, and delimited in various ways. So firstly, the circular emphasises that the lice are confined within the box and therefore their movements are restricted on the surface of the body. Secondly, the lice are kept from direct contact with the skin by the gauze barrier, which provides this kind of sterile cordon sanitaire between the parasite and the host. The lice are also hidden from public view by their virtue of their placement on the outer reaches of the limb, where they can be easily covered by clothing such as vests and socks, and therefore made invisible to the external observer on the street. As well as being hidden from public view, the circular suggests that the volunteer's own subjective awareness will be minimal because of the lack of any pain or discomfort. Importantly for scientists, this lack of an external sign and an inner sensation ensures that the intellectual labour of their work can continue without interruption. So this denial of pain was more, however, than just a cynical act of deception designed to trick people into volunteering to grow parasites on themselves. Indeed, Buxton's own reports and correspondence frequently underscore this lack of physical discomfort. This might be surprising to us because we might assume that scientists would want to frame the unpleasant act of rearing parasites on their own bodies as something heroic and selfless, as an offering of discomfort and indignity for the greater good of the wartime nation. So how might we make sense of the absence of those descriptions? Well, the most straightforward answer might be that it really was something that was painless and unobtrusive. However, fragments from the archive suggest otherwise. So Sidney Chave, a lab technician in the department, recalled that Buxton would often be seen clawing his legs red and raw to relieve the irritation. James Busfine, Buxton's second in command, later confessed that rearing lice caused considerable irritation for many and severe reactions for some. We can even read this indirectly in Buxton's own words in a letter he writes to a colleague at the MRC after recruiting another batch of volunteers, and where he declares that they could now study around 300 lice per week and, quote, not make anyone sore. It seems then, as we might assume, that rearing lice on one's body was not the most comfortable of processes. As such, I would argue that this official denial of pain tells us a lot more about how experimental labour was perceived rather than the actual physical sensations involved with it. And this is something we can see a particular kind of scientific citizenship emerge in Buxton's department and perhaps in the school more broadly. While conventional forms of wartime duty, such as industrial labour and military service, stress the importance of physicality, this kind of citizenship explicitly rejected the body as a primary site of patriotic sacrifice. We can see this, for example, in Buxton's push for more funding from the MRC in March 1940. Attempting to gain an extra grant for a colleague to explore the effects of climate on lice populations, Buxton used the threat of his impending military enlistment as a way of spurring the MRC on, noting that without funding, his colleague would have no choice but to go and enlist in His Majesty's services. Thus, rather than presenting military service as the highest potential honour for a healthy male, Buxton instead portrays enlistment as a tragic waste of intellectual potential. This privileging of the intellect over the body was something clearly shared by Buxton's colleagues beyond the department. For example, in one letter between WCC Topley, the school's chair of bacteriology, and the school's dean, Wilson Jameson, Topley implored Jameson to use his physical energy sparingly to ensure that his intellectual talents could be properly utilised for the war effort. As Topley notes, quote, "If you dislike Hitler as much as I do, don't overdo things." It is important to note that there's nothing inevitable about presenting scientific labour in this purely intellectual manner. Indeed, as the historian Rebecca Herzig has argued, scientists are often eager to stress what she calls the barter of bodies for data, with physical suffering presented as a necessary sacrifice for the advancement of scientific knowledge. For example, at this very period, researchers at Cambridge are conducting studies of rationing, an experiment which required little more than an excessive consumption of root vegetables. But however, this group was quick to frame their work in terms of a rugged physicality, from the tiring nature of chewing all the way down to their increased exertions in the bathroom. It's therefore interesting to see that their London colleagues are attempting to distance themselves from the trials and tribulations of the human body, achieved through acts of both visual and discursive obstruction. On the one hand, by hiding the affected areas of the skin away from public view, and on the other hand, by ignoring, downplaying, and hedging descriptions of pain and discomfort on the other. Participation in etymological research, then, was something that was to be considered an act of pure intellect in which the body was merely incidental. Interestingly, this would be a perception that would be reversed in the next group of research subjects. So by the spring of 1940, lab tests using the lice that had been reared on the bodies of scientific volunteers had identified a number of promising insecticides. The next step, Buxton argued, was to conduct field tests of these new chemicals on naturally infested human subjects, requiring an entirely different kind of research population. Reaching out to local medical officers and charitable organisations for help, such as Nichols and the Hungerford Club, as we've already seen, Buxton was soon made aware of the rich possibilities offered by London's homeless communities, recruiting around 30 men for the research, men who he referred to as infested tramps. While few surviving records document these men's experiences at the school, reports submitted to the MRC give us at least some sense of their comings and goings within the institution. On their arrival within the department, homeless subjects were first asked to remove all their clothing to allow for exact counts of lice to be made. Shirts and vests were then treated with a thin film of insecticide before being handed back to them. The men were then directed to wear these undergarments at all times without washing and report back 3 times a week for follow-up examinations. At these appointments, the numbers of dead and surviving lice would be counted to evaluate the efficacy of the insecticides used. To ensure that the men returned for these examinations, the department paid each subject 5 shillings per visit, which, accounting for inflation, is something around £12.50 today. Before delving deeper into the experiences of those subjects, it might be worth teasing out some of the broader connections between homelessness and citizenship in Britain around the time of the Second World War. After all, as historian Todd DiPistino has argued, perceptions of homelessness within a given society reveal a great deal about accepted notions of the country and the nation, particularly during periods of conflict and social upheaval. This is something we can certainly see in late 1930s Britain, when 2 competing discourses on homelessness and citizenship vied for dominance. On the one hand, there was the notion of the homeless citizen as an untapped social resource, a potentially productive citizen who merely required the right kind of charitable intervention. Such rhetoric particularly emphasised the redemptive power of labour, with fundraising literature of charities such as the SOS Society and the Homeless Poor Society filled with testimonies of men transformed from maligned vagrants into successful pilots, accountants, engineers, and in one case, fabric designers. In many ways, this transformative vision of work had been built into state-funded systems of poor relief since the 19th century, particularly in the casual wards where individual acts of work could be traded for a night's shelter. This system continued to operate in a surprisingly unmodified form into the 1930s, where recipients could secure clean clothes, food, and a place to sleep in return for an act of work, including digging, woodcutting, cleaning, and stone breaking. Often these acts of labour had little, if any, practical use, and instead were explicitly conceptualised by government circles as tests to prove whether recipients truly wished to better themselves or were merely looking for handouts. However, by the late 1930s, this redemptive view of homelessness was increasingly out of step with the more punitive approaches of government departments and local authorities, who presented the homeless instead as intransigent threats to social stability that required forceful correction. Take, for example, London County Council, who in 1937 declared that, and I quote, "The small men of women who small number of men and women who sleep in the streets do so in spite of the fact, which they very well know, that good beds are available for them." According to London County Council, then, homelessness was not a product of poverty, but rather an active choice based on an aversion for work and conventional ways of life. While we might expect a softening of this attitude during the war, when the indiscriminate nature of air raids meant that technically anyone could become homeless within a matter of minutes, these views, if anything, hardened. In 1943, for example, the Ministry of Health openly declared war on the homeless population, vowing in the Times to, and I quote, "eradicate the hardcore of veterans who stubbornly refused to give up their aimless wandering." How then did these debates about homelessness play out in Buxton's research? Now, in theory, the experiments could have provided homeless subjects with a form of redemptive labour, and thus an unconventional route to belonging and inclusion within a wartime community. However, this view is certainly not expressed in Buxton's reports, which instead obscure and discredit the painful experiences of homeless subjects in a way that places them outside of the bounds of that very community. We can see this first and foremost in the terminology Buxton employs to describe the men. By repeatedly describing them as infested tramps and vagrants, rather than other potential labels for homelessness being used during this period, on the other side of the spectrum, the far more romanticised terms wayfarer and wanderer, Buxton evokes a particular characterization of the homeless individual as a habitual seeker of charity who remains destitute by choice. The tramp was a distinct category of person in government documents, someone who, as a departmental committee of the Ministry of Health concluded, had a life unprofitable both to himself and the community at large. Such a person was therefore an unlikely candidate for valuable wartime labour in service of the greater good. Secondly, reports consistently attempted to deny and discredit the physical risk and discomfort of experimental participation. Buxton frequently denied that the homeless subjects experienced any discomfort whatsoever, stressing that no irritation was observed in any of his experiments. However, as with our scientific volunteers, fragmented glimpses of pain can be found elsewhere in the archive. A passing reference, for instance, to a particular chemical which caused diffuse erythema and some itching on application, and another disclaimer which suggests that the insecticides could react painfully with the skin during periods of excessive sweating, something which seemed highly likely considering that the subjects were living on the street during the unusually warm summer of 1940. Furthermore, when we cross-reference these fragments with testimonies such as Nichols at the beginning of the paper, it seems clear that many of the men involved in the study would have been in a state of severe physical deterioration as a result of prolonged rough sleeping and long-term infestation. Seeing as each subject was stripped down to the skin and thoroughly scrutinised before participating in the study, it seems unlikely that Buxton and his team would have been unaware of this. The absence of pain was buttressed by consistent efforts in Buxton's writings to devalue the ability of the homeless subject to accurately and honestly report on their own bodies and sensations. This is partially achieved through the stress placed on the financial reimbursement of the men, an act which, ironically, through putting a numerical value on their service, stripped it of all social and moral worth. Secondly, reports frequently frame the men as profoundly untrustworthy. This culturally embedded notion of the homeless person as a deceitful, fraudulent actor even came to influence the experimental protocols used. The subject's underclothing was covertly marked with blue colouring to ensure that they were not surreptitiously washing off the insecticide in between examinations. This distrust became even more explicit later in the experiment when Buxton informed the MRC that a number of results had to be abandoned as the team believed that, quote, "trafficking in lice has taken place because the men are unwilling to be freed and then discharged." Here Buxton once again presents the men as unreliable, greedy, and purely motivated by financial gain. Therefore, like the scientific volunteers who preceded them, pain and discomfort among homeless test subjects was hidden from view. However, unlike these scientific predecessors, this absence of pain was not utilised to construct an alternative place for them within the wartime community, but rather denial, devaluation and discrediting of painful sensations served to underscore their marginal status and present them as selfish, deceitful actors whose skin was never offered willingly but merely rented for hire. However, as we will see in the final research population I'm going to talk about, this thorough marginalisation was not the only outcome for a political and social outcast who offered their bodies for medical research. So by July 1940, with his grant almost exhausted, a number of promising insecticides identified, and his homeless subjects being discharged from experimental service, Buxton began to look for new lines of inquiry. One potential direction, he suggested, was to test the chemicals on a different insect vector, the Sarcoptes mite. The Sarcoptes, which burrows into the skin of its human host to lay its eggs, and was responsible for the spread of scabies, a contagious skin disease which caused intense itching and painful septic infections. As with louse-borne diseases, public health authorities feared that scabies cases would increase exponentially during the war, and anxiety exacerbated by the lack of scientific consensus about how exactly the mite moved from person to person. However, 150 miles away in Sheffield, one of Buxton's ex-colleagues was already one step ahead of him. Kenneth Mellenby, an entomologist who had left Buxton's department in the late 1930s to join the University of Sheffield, had already begun applying for funding from the Ministry of Health to investigate the transmission, development and treatment of scabies in human volunteers. This project was eventually green-lighted in November 1940. For the undesirable task of submitting to repeated parasitic infections and the testing of various untested chemical treatments, Mellenby, like Buxton, looked towards a group of political and social outcasts, this time conscientious objectors. Reaching out to local Sheffield branches of the Peace Pledge Union and the Friends Ambulance Unit, Mellenby was able to recruit 20 pacifist volunteers to serve on the experiment. So why would pacifists agree to participate in such a study? This decision has largely been viewed, both at the time and since, from two common sense angles. Either, as Mellenby himself emphasised, the men were selfless humanitarians who wished to help their fellow man, or else they were victims of a militarised culture who offered their bodies for medical research to avoid killing and dying on the battlefield. The reality, however, as is common in history, was somewhere in between, rooted in the ambiguous position of the British pacifist in the Second World War. On the one hand, military tribunals were broadly far more sympathetic to pacifists than they had been during the First World War, and this time around, very few objectors saw the inside of a jail cell. Yet at the same time, COs continued to face powerful social pressures with regards to their wartime service, or lack thereof. One need only look towards popular right-wing press coverage of COs during this period, particularly in the early years of the war, which consistently presented them as cowards, communists, sexual deviants, or some kind of combination of the three. Thus, this lack of official coercion, which had been the source of so much solidarity for pacifists during the First World War, combined with continuing pressures in their everyday lives, prompted many young pacifists to search for heroic, sacrificial and masculine forms of war work, for example, going overseas to serve as firemen, medics and aid workers. Mellenby's experiment then, with its noble medical objectives and painful bodily labours, provided a similar outlet for those impulses. In 1941, Mellenby subjects were participating in a range of unpleasant experiments designed to reveal how scabies were transmitted from one body to another. These included the wearing of unwashed, bloodstained military uniforms removed from infested servicemen to the sharing of beds with untreated local patients. Mellenby even briefly considered asking the men to sleep with infected sex workers to see if the condition could be transmitted venereally. What is most striking about the reports of these experiments is that when compared to those of Buxton's, it is their committed focus on the body and its sensations. Firstly, Mellenby recorded his intimate scrutiny of the volunteers' bodies, which were examined daily for any sign of infection. As Mellenby noted, he, and I quote from him, soon came to know thoroughly every inch of the subject's skin and could have recognised any of them by the physical or anatomical peculiarities of any part of the body, whether usually visible or invisible. Yet, as well as these exterior signs of infection, Mellenby was equally interested in the men's subjective self-reports, detailing their varied sensations as mites burrowed into their skin. In particular, Mellenby was fascinated with how the incessant and maddening itching caused by the condition transformed subjects' daily experiences of their own bodies. He recorded how the men kept rough brushes to rub over their skin, how they tore their pyjamas to shreds each night by scratching in their sleep, and how they walked around the house naked on cold nights to chill their inflamed and infected skin. So how might we explain this committed interest in the subjective, embodied and experiential dimensions of participating in research, considering the complete absence of those descriptions in earlier work? Well, here perhaps answers can be found by considering some of the non-scientific motivations for Mellenby's writings. At the beginning of the study, Mellenby confessed to having deep-seated prejudices against pacifists, finding them, quote, impossibly opinionated, pig-headedly obstinate, and incurably ignorant. and he was surprised, therefore, to find his subjects to be helpful, good-natured, and thoroughly committed to his experimental objectives. As such, he found himself wanting to secure what he called a good deal for them in his reporting of the experiment, so that he might, and this comes from a letter Mellenby sent to his uncle a few years later, ensure their fair treatment after the war, where a man who has skulked and slacked in a war factory for 10 times the pay of a soldier will probably get preferential treatment compared to the pacifist who has given the most valuable service. It's perhaps this desire to refute conceptions of the pacifist as a skulker and a slacker, as Mellenby terms it, that drives his in-depth mediations on his volunteers' stoic endurance of extreme discomfort, their complete willingness to endure indignity and embarrassment, and their seemingly superhuman stamina as infections were allowed to progress without treatment for as long as 9 months at a time. Yet Mellenby's prejudices were not entirely eliminated by the brave performances of his subjects, and traces of their outsider status nonetheless remained in his reporting. For example, on one occasion in May 1941, when a volunteer appeared before a military tribunal in Leeds, Mellenby scoffed at what he saw as an exaggerated portrayal of the man's heroism in the local press. As Mellenby noted, "The papers attempted to magnify the horrors of his sufferings and the value of his services. All his suffering had actually consisted of was contact with none too cleanly clothing and bedding, but by some accounts, he was a veritable martyr for science." Such comments resonated with this ambiguous position of the pacifist in broader society, whose labours were always being placed upon this sliding scale between the heroic idealist on one hand and the cynical malingerer on the other. As Mellenby so ably summarised himself, his subjects were to be considered, quote, in no way either saints or sissies, but rather something in between. If Mellenby, the volunteer's most vocal champion, had mixed feelings about their experimental labours, it's perhaps unsurprising that the men had a similarly mixed reception in broader society. On the one hand, local newspapers were broadly supportive, with the Sheffield Telegraph, for example, carrying letters that describe volunteers as heroes with conscience who demand respect. Another volunteer suggested that support for them in the local area was such that, quote, to be a pacifist here has almost ceased to be a stigma. Yet not everyone had been so won over by the pacifist services. For example, Henry Dale, president of the Royal Society, downplayed the extent of the men's physical sacrifices and warred against the MRC, giving them what he saw as the privilege of a rather fictitious heroism. Similarly, military tribunals viewed Mellenby's experiment with a profound ambivalence, refusing to officially recognise the work as a matter of national importance, and even prosecuting volunteers if they ignored directions to undertake agricultural or civil defence work instead. In the case of the pacifist, then, pain had not been obscured and hidden away, as it had in the scientific volunteer, or denied and discredited, as it had been in the homeless test subject, but rather painful cessations had been subjected to an intense and committed scrutiny. However, this embrace of the physical, subjective, and embodied dimensions of experimental participation did not provide a simple linear route to wartime acceptance. Therefore, despite Mellenby's attempts to provide the men with a kind of social rehabilitation, elements of their outsider status nonetheless persisted. So, to draw some conclusions from these three case studies, as we've seen across these three episodes of entomological research, the marked bleeding and compromised skin of the research subject was far from a straightforward and stable document of patriotic service. Rather, it functioned as a polysemic symbol, a screen upon which wildly varying visions of societal unity and division could be projected at a time when such concepts faced unprecedented physical, social, and geopolitical threats. It might here be helpful to return to Sara Ahmed's statement, which I began this talk with, that it is here on the skin surface that histories are made. In the context of wartime entomological research, we can see two competing possibilities for such a statement. On the one hand, there's the possibility that political and social realities might be transformed through the performances of human bodies as research objects. Through this kind of service, a scientist might be transformed into a wartime hero, a homeless person into a socially valued actor, and a pacifist into an honourable martyr. However, on the other hand, we see that the achievement of such transformations is never a foregone conclusion. Such opportunities remain constrained within clear boundaries of gender, race, class, and economic status, and must necessarily defer to hierarchies of feeling and economies of sympathy that code some modes of suffering as socially valuable while labelling others for historical deletion. With this in mind, perhaps fringe projects of wartime research can help us think beyond the confines of the Second World War. It seems particularly fitting this week that we might consider what sacrifices, both physical and otherwise, are demanded from individuals and groups on the fringes of society who wish to belong, and what kinds of pain and suffering, both recognised and obscured, are embedded within national objectives of survival, enrichment and advancement. Thank you very much.
So we've got about 15 or 20 minutes for questions, so does anyone want to kick us off? Yeah?
I'm not sure if you'll be able to answer. It was a bit about the research at the beginning, the description of this box. Mm-hmm. And I noted that it said that they didn't have to wear them overnight.
Yes.
Is that about priority?